be the way the audience figures out who you are
okay.
by you introducing yourself. Are we, we're okay?
All right. All right, I'm going to do the same thing with my mic here. So go ahead and just introduce yourself.
Sure. My name is Alberta Lee, and I'm speaking on behalf of my family and my father, Wenho Lee.
Okay, if you can say the same thing, but just say, I am or I'm Alberta Lee, okay. as opposed to my name is.
Sure. I'm Alberta Lee. I'm Alberta Lee, speaking on behalf of my family and my father, Wenho Lee.
Very good. Tell me your personal reaction when you first heard the charges that were being leveled against your father, that he was being investigated for spying and so on.
I first realized the severity of the investigation upon reading the New York Times in March of 1999, when I was aware that my father had been questioned, but I didn't realize the severity of the investigation. I was reading through an article, and I realized that the article was describing my parents, and it was quite a shock.
And did your dad know at that point? Was that the first your dad knew how serious the whole situation was?
Well, you know, he met with the FBI on over 20 occasions without an attorney, each meeting lasting sometimes up to 4 to 5 hours, 4 or 5 hours. So I really believe that my father thought he was helping the FBI with the investigation, did not know that he was the target of the investigation.
And so was that time with the newspaper, because I remember that newspaper article very well. I remember it too. It was a front page story. Was that the first time that he also realized how serious the situation was for him?
I think that was around the same time. It was a combination of, I believe, the fairly adversarial interrogation by the FBI agents who had been befriending him all along, as well as seeing this front page article that kind of brought him to his senses about the severity of the situation.
What impact did that revelation, that understanding, have on the family, on your mom, on your dad, on your brothers and sisters?
Well, there's just my brother and
sorry.
Me. That's okay. I think my family was just in shock that this could happen in America. We really always believed that if you come to the United States and you work hard, keep your head down, and don't rock the boat and don't do too much, there's not much going on. We were never really awakened to discrimination in America until this case happened to my father. For better or for worse, we pretty much kind of lived what's known as the model minority type of existence, where we just kind of didn't really care about politics very much and floated along through life trying to do the best that we could. And I think this situation was a huge wake-up call for my entire family, as well as many Asian Americans.
Tell me, for you, in your own personal case, so you were, this was 5-6 years ago, so I'm guessing based on your law school grad, you were like, what, late teenager?
No.
How old
were you? I was 26.
You were 20. Oh, I see. You've been back to school. Okay.
Yeah, I went back to school. I was leading the model minority life. I was working at a large high-tech company as partially as a technical writer, marketing engineer type of thing, a multinational large tech company, and really trying to climb the corporate ladder, saving up as much as I could, trying to get promoted, save up for an early retirement, that sort of thing, and not really thinking about any larger impact I might have in the world or that my family might have in the world. And I think now I've realized that there's so much work to be done. There's so much hurt in the world, and also in the United States, there's so much hypocrisy and a lot of work to be done with regards to social justice and racism. And I spent a couple of years deciding whether or not to go to law school, and decided that it was probably the best way for me to figure out if there's a career out there where I could actually give back to people rather than promoting myself.
Now, did you feel at this time, now before 1999, did you ever feel that you were personally discriminated against because you were Chinese American?
I think looking back, there were times when I really didn't want to believe it was about my race or my appearance. And I'm sure if I think back enough, there are times that I could raise certain questions, whether or not it's due to me personally, my culture, or the way I'm perceived. That's really something that you can leave up to other people to decide. But I'd have to say that I did not really give much thought to race, culture, society, discrimination before my father's case.
Okay. Let's talk just, if you can, just, yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. How's that?
Testing.
Right. Go ahead, just count to five.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
So, towards me. Oh, I see, this way. Oh, I see, I got you. All right, oops, sorry about that.
That's okay.
Okay, how, let's see, how's that? Go ahead.
Just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Are we okay, or do you want to be closer?
It's okay.
What is?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
All right.
Good. Thanks. Thanks for the patience.
No problem.
Okay, we're rolling, I presume. Describe just succinctly what the original legal case on all the, not the formal charges, but the what was leaked to the media about what your father had allegedly done.
Sure. In March of 99, leading newspapers, mainstream national newspapers, printed that my father was the main suspect for passing nuclear weapons information on to China. And a large percentage of these articles would allude to various congressional investigations that confirmed that China had stolen nuclear weapons information from the United States. And at the time, the political climate between the United States and China was extremely tense. It was also an election year, so there's quite a bit of pressure to link President Clinton to the to China and to making illegal transfers of satellite technology and other things. There's also the campaign finance scandal. Sure, there was also the campaign finance scandal going on at the time. So the political climate was extraordinarily negative, and all of these articles alleged that my father had been this basically a spy for China, notwithstanding his Taiwanese ethnicity, notwithstanding his U.S. citizenship, notwithstanding his presence in the United States for over 30 years, as well as his family's presence in the United States for so long.
And when they finally actually filed federal charges against Succinctly, what was it that they charged him?
They charged him with downloading or mishandling classified information. They charged him with 59 counts underneath the Atomic Energy Act of 1954. This is an act which has never been used before, previously. It's actually part of, you could say, the... Sorry,
just start again.
It's part of... I'm trying to think of the... What was it called? I'm blanking on his name. When everyone was trying to accuse everyone else of being communist in the 50s.
McCarthy.
Thank you. My father was charged with 59 counts of mishandling classified information underneath the 1954 Atomic Energy Act, which was previously never used ever in a criminal investigation. A lot of people presume that the Atomic Energy Act came out of the McCarthy era.
Okay. But there was no charge, even in that, at that, by that point, there was no charge of spying.
There was never any charges formally of spying.
Now, ultimately, describe what he pled guilty to after all of this hassle.
Sure. He pled guilty to one count of mishandling classified information after spending 278 days in solitary confinement.
And he did plead to one count, one felony count, right?
He did plead guilty to one felony count.
And why did he enter that plea?
Pretty much to end the nightmare that everyone was going
through.
I'm sorry,
just say it as a complete sentence, if you don't mind.
Oh, sure. I believe my father pled guilty to the single count, and all 58 other counts were dropped because he wanted to end his time in jail and things also. We could have gone to trial, but it would have just taken much longer, and we wanted the nightmare to end.
And what was it that the judge said? It was pretty extraordinary when he the final plea bargain was entered.
Judge James Parker was amazing in court, and we weren't expecting really anything to be said, like the statement that he made. But when he released my father, he read from a multi-page statement for about 15, 20 minutes, or it felt like 15, 20 minutes, and pretty much explained to the court that he felt misled by several branches of the government, including the Department of Energy, Federal Bureau of Instant Investigation, as well as the Clinton administration, to hold my father without bail in December of 99. This was September of 2000 when Judge Parker read from his statement, and did not really understand why, if at the time that my father was charged in December of 99, why was it that my father held the crown jewels, the U.S. nuclear arsenal, that releasing my father would be a you bet your country type of bet, and that, you know, very, very dramatic statements made by government witnesses, why was it suddenly in September of 2000 my father could be freed to go home? And it's basically because of the flimsiness of the evidence that the government had against my father, and not being able to find really anything on him. They scoured my family's lives all the way down to, all the way back to where my parents were born, pretty much, and everything that my brother and I ever had in our lives.
Sorry. Describe the conditions that he faced in solitary, and why do you think the government did that to him?
Well, the first month in which he was detained, he was held in a single cell with a blue light that shined 24 hours a day in his room, which apparently is against Amnesty International regulations. He was given food and water, but not allowed to go outside on weekends and not allowed showers on weekends. He was also prevented from receiving media and mail at first, but over time the restrictions lessened. The hardest thing, I think, was he was shackled and chained. His ankles and his wrists were shackled and chained whenever he was moved around in the jail. And for his family, for me, the hardest part was visiting him in jail and seeing him being treated like an animal. I think for him, the hardest part was the food. He was given extremely poor food. He had colon cancer approximately 15 years ago, and more than 15 years ago, almost 20 years ago, and it has changed his diet significantly. Most of the food that was given to him was meat, cheese, pork-based, and he's tries to stick to a non-meat-based type of diet. And he was pretty much restricted from a lot of things until our defense attorney started putting more pressure on to help alleviate some of the severity of the conditions. I think they treated him like this for a number of reasons. I think they thought they could break him. They thought that he would confess to something he did not do. My father maintained his innocence steadfast from beginning through end, largely because he knew he was innocent. And I think that was why he just stood that ground. And he never wanted to do anything that would compromise his position. He never wanted to. I think it was just seeing the toll that his incarceration took on the family, as well as the expenses that the attorneys were incurring, that he really wanted to end the nightmare. And that was why he pled guilty.
And I read the book that he and Helen wrote. And,
oh, great.
In it, if I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, that his argument was that he admitted that he did download some things to personal computers. It was basically a way to continue work at home. It had nothing to do with espionage or even improper activity.
Actually, he never took any of this information home. He actually came home every day with an empty briefcase with his brown paper bag rolled up inside it, because he would reuse his brown lunch bag. That's how frugal he is. The information that he downloaded was from one network to another. It was always in the office, always behind the firewalls at the laboratory. This was also in the early 90s, when much of the internet was primarily for government use or academic use, but the public was not really accessing it very much. And there, the government made it sound like it was really easy to break in, but it actually wasn't. He made all these copies of backup work because there had been problems with the systems in the past where people were losing their work and losing their data. When you update these large files, you know, it's like if anyone's lost a Microsoft Word document knows they should back it up. And that's what my father was doing. At that time, it was making tapes and copying files back and forth because they weren't really things you could put on a diskette. They weren't such small files.
God, I do remember that. So it was not only espionage, it wasn't even something that was improper. It was simply backing up the material that he was
correct.
Working on.
And the material wasn't even really classified. It was all classified as what's technically, by the government standards, in an unclassified category called protect as restricted data. Protect as restricted data and unclassified data are both considered to be unclassified. And then above that are restricted, then secret restricted, then top secret. What happened was all the work my father had was protect as restricted data. It was only once he was publicly named, fingered, and our home was searched that the government went through and looked at the files that were PARD, classified as protect as restricted data, actually took those files and then reclassified them as restricted data and secret restricted data, kind of like an ex post facto classification of the work he was working on, which to me was a setup.
Why do you think, given that basically the government's case completely fell apart by the end, why do you think they had done as much as they had? Why did they single out your father?
I think a lot of the pressure came from, like I was saying before, the conditions at the time, a tremendous amount of tension between the United States and China. I think it's also because it was an election year. There was a lot of pressure to make Al Gore looked like he was linked somehow to Vice President Gore looking like he was linked to these China transfers, these supposed legal relationship with China. And also try to make it look like the Clinton administration was soft on China. And my father was a simple, normal man plucked from obscurity. And I'm sure the FBI never thought that he would stand his ground.
So it could have been any Chinese American who worked at the lab. Do you think that's true?
Well, I think that because there was a document called the motion for discovery on selective prosecution that was filed. This was basically a legal document asking the government to produce information about why my father was singled out over other people, numerous other people who committed similar, if not more egregious, violations of mishandling classified information. I think if you look at that document, you'd see that there was definitely a culture of scrutinizing Chinese scientists, even if, no matter if they're from Taiwan or from mainland China, didn't make a difference to them. And I also believe that the fact that a number of Asian Americans filed a class action lawsuit after my father's case probably leads to, people can draw an inference that there is some sort of a climate of scrutinizing foreign nationals at the national laboratories, which is really quite damaging because ever since the Manhattan Project, we've always relied on international scientists for the physics and engineering capabilities. And it's really hurt our defense systems to be doing this, to be this distrustful of people who have come here to work for the United States.
Describe briefly the role of the major media in your father's case and how the impact of all these leaks and the role they played.
Well, I believe the media has a duty to report information to the public, and I believe they have a duty to report this information responsibly. And in my father's case, what I observed was somewhat of a pack mentality where newspaper reporters, as well as other media reporters, would really kind of share the same information, the same sound bites, and not really dig beneath the surface to see what the story was going on, what kind of story might really be happening there. It wasn't until the government's case began to fall apart that the media really started to be interested in my family as what's going on here and wanting to get to know us. And at that point, I think the media tried to create a more balanced picture of the case. Before, I'd say at least March of 99 through June of 2000, we were fighting an uphill battle, largely against the mainstream media that really felt strongly and believed in government sources that were telling them that my father was definitely guilty of spying for China.
What would a good reporter have done differently in those early months when they're presenting all these secret documents and investigations pointing towards his guilt and accusing him of major crimes?
Well, I think if the person that is in question, my father, for example, was a private figure, he was a normal, everyday individual. I think if reporters in the future are given information about a private individual who's never presented themselves to be in the public arena at all, I think the journalist should be particularly careful about naming that person and putting that person in any sort of light in the public eye. I think if it's a public official, it's a little bit more fair game, right? But I think if it's a normal, everyday person on the street, you don't really want to pluck them from obscurity and anonymity and make them a household name or recognizable at Home Depot and other things like that. It's very hurtful.
You've studied your law and public figures, yes.
I just took the bar exam.
yes, indeed. Tell me about the impact of the case. I mean, this had to have been tremendously wrenching on your family. Did this cause internal rifts? I mean, what impact did it have on the family?
I think it actually brought us a lot closer. We were, my brother was in medical school. I was working at a high-tech company, and we were really trying to carve out our adult lives. And not that we weren't close, but we weren't spending that much time together. And suddenly this case brought us much closer and kind of blurred some of our normal roles, as well as kind of helped us become closer and get over some of our old issues. And
give me an example of some of the old issues.
Well, for me, I was always the little girl of the family. And I was also the one who really urged my father to get an attorney early on in the situation. And he refused to get an attorney, largely because he thought they were too expensive. He'd paid for a will once before, a couple $100s, and ranted that it was too expensive. He's very frugal, like I said before. So I think that now, in retrospect, my family sees that I actually could be taken more seriously and wasn't just crying wolf or anything like that. And
Was part of that kind of a traditional way of a family looking at their daughter? Was that part of it?
Maybe. I mean, I am the youngest kid and I am the daughter. I do get away with more than my brother does, my older brother does. Certainly there's sibling rivalry and there always will be. But I think also we're an Asian family and there are, to some degree, certain roles expected of the family, cooking, wrapping presents, being a good hostess, that sort of thing. Not really being expected to do yard work. There's some nice things about being an Asian girl. But nevertheless, I think it did bring our family much closer, especially our extended relatives. There were negative points also. I think we had some friends who weren't quite sure what to do, how to react towards us. And even within the small community of Los Alamos, we did have some friends whose parents told them not to talk to my brother and me anymore. And that was pretty hurtful, but also we understood because that's how Los Alamos works. It's a very small town.
Mm-hmm. And do you think, I know you've read, I'm sure, about the case of Vincent Chin. Do you see any similarities in that case and your father's case, particularly in terms of kind of smashing the model minority myth?
I do. I think that in both situations, Chinese Americans realized that they were being looked at in a particular manner, which I think in both Vincent Chin and in my father's case, Chinese Americans realized that they did need to be much more vigilant, much more politically aware, politically involved, and they need to also be cognizant of stereotyping that occurs somehow among the masses in America, that Chinese Americans are perceived to be a certain way or another way. And I think that in both situations, other than having Helen Zia involved, which is wonderful, she was just a wonderful role model for me, I think in both situations also Chinese Americans organized ad hoc overnight in casual manners and informal manners to really rally to support the person that was involved, that was being victimized at the time.
Now, I think one of the things that was unusual in your father's case was that there was an appeal to scientists and engineers and people maybe who hadn't been politically active before. Do you think they had a perception that they had made it, or that this kind of racism wasn't really something that affected them, and this case really opened their eyes?
I think that I would classify the support that we received from the Chinese American community, from the scientific community, and from religious groups. And I would say that having support from Chinese Americans was absolutely crucial in raising awareness, and as well as other areas for my father's defense. But once the scientific groups, once the American Physical Society, the National Institute of Sciences, Committee for Concerned Scientists, once so many scientific groups came on board to support my father to write letters to Janet Reno, that was when the tide really began to change. That was when it was no longer an issue about race, but also an issue about scientific matters, as well as our nation's defense and how it was being impacted. And I really wish that race had not been such a large issue sometimes, but it also awakened me to how much race is integrated and pervasive throughout our culture, and how difficult it is to address and to fix the problems of racism. And I think that it's a problem that's going to be around for a while and won't go away, but it took awareness of the issues of race, as well as issues of national security, or the pretext of national security, and scientific organizations, religious organizations who came up to help us. It took all of these people to really change the tide, which I was really grateful for and still am today.
Briefly, tell me what the civil suit is.
We filed, I think, over 100 violations of the 1972 Privacy Act, in which I actually haven't had time to read the briefs or the motions, and you might want to ask Brian's son about this, but the civil suit was filed because numerous branches of the U.S. government leaked confidential and private information about my family to the public in the public domain, which normally no one is supposed to know, information about your assets, your children's names, your activities, any of your involvements at work, for example, and things like that. And so we filed this civil suit, and the crux of the suit really turns on identifying whether or not the anonymous sources which supplied information to the newspapers, whether or not these anonymous sources came from the Department of Energy or the FBI or the CIA or the DOE. And so what we're hoping just that will happen in the civil suit is that the newspaper reporters will be compelled to name one of the government organizations.
Okay. One last question. How's your dad doing now? It's been a few years. Just on a personal level, how's he doing?
Most of the time he's okay. He's dealt with this in his own way. He kind of does his own thing. He's actually printed a mathematics textbook on, I think, linear algebra, as well as a couple of publications in international journals regarding fluid dynamics. And he spends a lot of his time still fishing and gardening. He's a simple man. He grew up in a farm, and he's still kind of got that farmer boy in him. But I think he remains unsettled with his position in the United States. And it's difficult. There's a lot of, I think my whole family has a certain amount of emotions, but we know that we weren't It wasn't a purposeful thing. We were just there, and I don't want to come across as angry or resentful, but much of the time I am angry and resentful, and I think my father, in his own way, deals with these emotions, and I, in my own way, I do a lot of yoga, you know, to work out the anger. So it's still a continuing process to heal from the pain.
Is it public information where he's living now? I don't mean the address, but the city.
Sure. Well, I just usually say he lives in Northern California.
Okay, that's fine. Okay. Great. Thank you so much.
Sure. Thank
you.
That's
wonderful.
Thank you.
I think it went really well, and I appreciate your honesty and
forthrightness. You're welcome.
So, like I said, should he... I respect his privacy and his situation. Should that situation change and he wants to talk, I'd be happy to come up to Sacramento.
Thank you. Do you know when this is going to air?
Yeah, it's not going to air until February of 2006, next
goodness.
Year, because for Asian American History, Asian Week, okay. Month, I should say.
Okay.
But the reason we're doing it now is because we're getting all of there's a long lead time to get 8 hours together.